Well, this is these are slides actually from a talk I gave at Berkeley, so it's an hour long. I assume that's not a problem, but I will try to skip through. I will try to skip through this. Okay. So this is work I'm doing with Doug Hamilton. He was on sabbatical at SWERI, and we got involved in this problem. The original puzzle we were looking at was to try to understand, see if we could come up with an explanation as to why the obliquities of Jupiter and Saturn are so different. I mean, the obliquities of the planets vary a lot, but generally, most of that can be explained, we think, just by the stochastic accretion process. But Jupiter and Saturn, if you believe the core accretion model, most of the material we think is added as a hydrodynamic flow. So it's hard to explain why you'd have an in-plane angular momentum from this, and particularly much more for Saturn than Jupiter. It doesn't seem right. So, you know, does this mean that our ideas of giant planet formation is wrong, or is there some other explanation for this? So that's what we sort of tried to find, another explanation for this. This just makes the point that you know, if you have a core initially, then it can have any obliquity. So you could have a core lying on its side, spinning at critical, and add gas, and you can get a little obliquity, but you can't. You can maybe get Jupiter's, but you can't get Saturn's this way. So that can't be it. Of course, you can always appeal to a giant impact, but the impact would have to be so big to knock Saturn over that it's actually competitive with the core. Okay, so it doesn't seem very satisfying either. Okay, so what else can change obliquities? Well, there's, you know, these planets are pretty big, have a lot of angular momentum, but compared to orbital angular momentum, spin angular momentum is still minuscule. So what you need is some way to couple the problem between the orbits and the spins. And you can do this through various kinds of spin orbit resonances. And in particular, we know that the Mars obliquity, right, is oscillating a lot as a result of spin orbit coupling between its precession rate of Mars' spin axis and the precession rate of the Mars orbit plane. And now, these spin orbit resonances are basically one-to-one commensurabilities between the spin axis and orbit precession. So you have to know what the spin axis precession of the planet is. So first thing you have to realize is that Jupiter, most of the torque on the Jupiter and Saturn systems are really on the satellites, not the planet. The satellites then communicate the torque to the planet through the quadrupole field of the planet itself. So you have to make sure you get the right inventory in there. And it also tells you that this could have changed in the past. Satellites evolve tidally. Satellites form initially from circumplanetary disks. Planets themselves contract, which can change their quadrupole field. So there are ways of changing this spin axis precession frequency. There's also ways of changing the orbit precession frequency. If in the early solar system there were adjustments being made, migration of planets, ejection of material, and so forth. So these frequencies are not fixed. Now, what we're making is a case that, in fact, Saturn is at present locked in a resonance with Neptune. We think that it is locked in a spin orbit resonance with what's called the new 1/8, which is one of the modes of the Laplace-Lagrange secular evolution of the solar system, one of the inclination ones, and it's the one that primarily is described by Neptune's orbit plane. And that this, in fact, is the cause of Saturn's spin axis obliquity, and its initial obliquity was probably very small, just like Jupiter. So how do we evaluate this possibility? Well, first, a few comments, general comments, about how a spin orbit secular resonance works. There's a lot of commonality between this and, say, orbit-orbit secular resonances. The phase diagrams are similar, except here you can actually make these phase diagrams on a unit sphere. So let's take the simplest case of spin axis precession. S is the spin axis unit spin axis vector. Let's imagine N is an orbit normal, and the planet is tilted slightly and it's precessing. There's a precessional constant that involves the J2 of the planet, or the effective J2 if there are satellites involved, and the angular momentum in the bottom, which involves the normalized moment of inertia of the planet, its spin rate, so forth. And if the orbit is fixed, you just simply get the uniform orbital precession. It's weakly dependent on the obliquity, but that turns out to be very important to us. You can change this a little bit by changing the obliquity, the rate of spin axis precession. But we want to now go a little bit more complicated. We want the orbit itself to be precessing at some frequency we'll call g. So this is the situation we want to look at. Here's an invariable plane, there's an orbit plane, it's precessing. So now n is no longer fixed, it's the normal to the invariable plane k that's fixed. The spin axis is still trying to get around n though, but n's moving, so it has to try to catch it all the time. And this can produce some, you know, variation in the obliquity that you don't get in this simple problem here. And the way to do this simply is to simply move to a rotating coordinate frame so that the orbit's fixed again. But now the frame's non-inertial, so you pick up this extra non-inertial term. This is a very well-studied problem, originally studied by Giuseppe Colombo, who I had the privilege to know. This is a very classic paper. This is from a classic paper of his in 1966. And he showed that you can integrate that equation. You get a Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian can be put into the form of a parabola. So you have a body, you have a system of parabolas here, and the intersection of these parabolas with the unit sphere gives you the trajectory of the spin axis. And the axis of the parabola depends on the ratio of this spin axis precessional constant, alpha, and the orbit precession frequency, g. And if you change that, you change the height of this axis. You also change the sort of opening angle of the parabolas. Now notice that if I were to choose different vertices, I can find various parabola that just barely touch the unit sphere, or tangent to it. And so the trajectories in this case degenerate to a point. These are called Cassini states. Stan Peale is, in fact, one of the earlier developers of this whole theory. Much of my work is based on learning this whole technique from Stan's papers. So there are four of these places, and they're labeled 1, 2, 3, 4. That's the convention. Three of them are stable in the sense that spin axis would tend to circulate one of these states if it were slightly away from it. One of them is unstable and lies on a separatrix. That's the state 4. Notice that if I take this axis and I move it too high so that I don't get the tops of the parabolas hitting the unit sphere anymore, then I can't get states 1 and 4. So down here, for instance, is a plot of the angular position. The convention here is to use negative angles if it's on this side and positive angles on this side. This shows the position of these Cassini states, these points of tangency, as a function of alpha over g. We're ignoring this one, which is a retrograde state, which actually we just won't be interested in this particular problem. And sure enough, if you get alpha too small, it turns out that this height here is proportional to the inverse of this. The axis gets too high, and you lose these two states. They tend to merge, and then you only have state 2 and state 3, which would be a retrograde state. All right. Now, what's the significance of this? Well, let's suppose that we have a situation where we're going to form a planet. It has very small obliquity when it's initially formed. It has some value of alpha over g at the moment it forms. Could be over here, could be over here. And then we're gonna imagine we can change this. And we'll change it in such a way as that we try to run through this area right here, which we will call the resonance. We'll define the exact resonance as right here where the state 1 and 4 disappear. So if we're over here, we try to go this way. If we're over here, we try to go this way. Well, but what happens here is, in the case of orbit-orbit resonances, it's not reversible. It depends on which way you go. One way you capture into this resonance, the other way you don't. This is the non-captured direction. If we form a planet over here, and then we change this ratio very slowly, one can show that the area inside the trajectory is an adiabatic invariant, if it's slowly enough. And so the object, if it's initially almost right in state one, will simply follow state one as it begins to migrate away from the orbit normal. And that's what's happening here, except it's negative because I'm on this side. State four, on the other hand, is migrating towards the orbit normal. And eventually, it destabilizes state one, and suddenly the spin axis finds itself stranded. Okay, so the only thing it can do now is circulate this one. So now it's going around this one with a fairly large area. And then if it continues, if I continue in that direction, this state two will rotate near N on the other side. But by then, you've got a big obliquity, and the area is preserved, and you wind up with a fairly large obliquity. So you've generated obliquity from a planet that initially had no obliquity. All right, now, if you start from the other side, this is a passage in the capture direction. So now I start off here, over here, with a very small obliquity. I go this direction. And so state two begins to rotate this way. If it starts up here, say, it begins to rotate down this way. But the planet, it never becomes unstable. The planet can simply track it. And so, in fact, it can get to very high obliquities, provided it's not actually knocked out of this thing by some external process, which is possible. Well, this is what we think is the key, that Saturn somehow passed through this kind of a resonance in the capture direction. And we can generate very high obliquities. These are very large, from very small terms, very small angles in the orbit. So what is the resonance we're interested in? Well, the orbit plane of Saturn has has a lot of terms in it, but there are three principal terms. The new 1.6, 1.7, and 1.8. This one here is due to a mutual precession of Jupiter and Saturn. It has about a 50,000 year period. This one is due to perturbations from Uranus with about a 500,000 year period. And this one is due to perturbations from Neptune, which is about 2 million years. Now, this is the inclination. This is the amplitude of these terms. So you can see they're very small. These terms here, for instance, are less than a tenth of a degree. But if I were to go through the resonance, and in each of these cases, in this direction here, and generate this kick, and that's not captured, but it's kicked, we can calculate the size of that kick analytically. And it's a very simple formula. And this shows the obliquity kick you get as a function of the amplitude of the resonance. I'm comparing Jupiter and Saturn here. So we're trying to contrast them. So you can see the new 1.6 with about a half of a degree is very powerful and can pump up the obliquities of both these planets too much. Saturn winds up here at much higher than it actually is. And Jupiter is, of course, ridiculously high. So we actually have to avoid this. But if these planets originally had a satellite disk from which the satellites were formed, I'll show in a minute that, in fact, the position of these planets would, their original precession frequencies would put them over here, and they would have to go through this. So we have to figure out how to get through this without producing these high obliquities. The current positions of 2 pi over alpha, the precession rates of Jupiter and Saturn right now, forgetting their obliquities, the small variations of the obliquities, are located here. And surprisingly, they're very near these two principal terms. Okay. And this is the one we're going to concentrate on here. We're working on Jupiter right now, but there's not enough time to go through this. We're going to concentrate on Saturn. Okay. Here's just a diagram showing how you can change the precession rate. There's a planet. Here was the alpha I originally had. If you put satellites around it, you have to add in their effective J2. And if you put a disk, you have to do the same thing. And here, with a typical disk, you can get very, very short precession times for these planets initially. So that's why I say that they're probably start well over here in terms of this precession period and have to go through these terms. Now, the way to get through this very powerful new 1-6 term, which we don't want to work on either planet that hard, is to go through it rapidly. In other words, these were adiabatic values. So what we want to do is to go through them fast enough that the planet cannot actually follow that state 1 as it rolls over and then goes unstable. And we can solve this, and we find that you get a kick, but it's rate dependent. It tends to be inversely proportional to the rate at which you change alpha. And so we can define a characteristic timescale to pass through the resonance as what is necessary to kick the obliquity by what we see. In the case of Jupiter, this obliquity is very small. We don't want to violate the 3-degree obliquity. So this says we have to get through the new 1-6 in very short time, 60,000 years. So this puts an upper limit on the time scale that you could have a disk around Jupiter. Okay, if you try to remove the disk too slowly, Jupiter rolls over. So that's the first thing we learned.
Well, I'm a little confused about that. So if you pass through the thing non-adiabatically, don't you have a range of possibilities?
Sure. Sure. And I'm asking for the result to be 3 degrees. Anything slower than that, you get too large of an obliquity. So what I'm doing is, instead of going through here slowly and then doing this, I'm going here through here so fast that all I do is pick up a little bit of a frequency.
So what I'm saying is, how do you know what that little bit is? How come? I mean, don't you have a?
We have a current value. We have a current value for the Jupiter obliquity.
Yes.
And we ask the question, well, how fast would we have to go through the new 1-6 in order to not get an obliquity bigger than that?
Is there really a one-to-one relationship?
No, you can go through it. You can go through it even faster and not get enough for the 3-degree obliquity. And Jupiter could have had a 3-degree obliquity before it even encountered it.
What I'm confused about is what puts the limit on. If you go through fast enough that you're non-adiabatic,
right?
Don't you end up with just some chaotic jump?
No. No. You get a jump that is proportional to 1 over the square root of the rate.
Doesn't it depend on the path?
If you start with a 0 obliquity, then it does not. It's not chaotic. Okay? But if you start with an obliquity, then it is, because you can, depending on what the phase is, you can either add or subtract. So there's an uncertainty there if you have a phase ahead of time. So, but we just want to know how fast can we get through, how slow can we go through and not violate 3 degrees. So the best case is to start off with virtually nothing and try not to pick up more than 3 degrees.
Bill, could I ask, what about the J2 due to the spin of the planet? Is that a problem? Would that ever come in?
It will, and I'll get back to that. I'm going to touch on that later, yeah. We'll talk about this later, okay? And this is a very simple problem. It's not chaotic. Okay. Okay, so, but we're really concentrating on Saturn, so let's get back to Saturn, okay? Now, Saturn has a 26.7 degree obliquity. You know, well, we could maybe get that going through the new 1-6 much slower than Jupiter did. But that doesn't explain why it's near the new 1-8 right now. The fact that it's sitting right next to the new 1-8, I think, is what we want to use. The period for the new 1-8 is almost 2 million years, 1.86 times 10 to the 6th years, based on Applegate model. There's some other models, but they vary only like in the third digit. The spin axis precession rate is actually not as well known here. I've chosen a specific moment of inertia, 0.225, and that's not known very well. The interior models really can't pinpoint that very well. In fact, we're getting a constraint on that might be useful for interior models. But if you use 0.225, then you can get almost a match between these precession rates. Okay, so if this is not a coincidence, then we have to explain, you know, how we can maintain this, because we know that alpha and g had been different in the past. Okay? So the natural way to do it is to use this term right here as the regulator, a tuning mechanism. And that's basically what happens when you go through one of these resonances in the capture direction. So remember, going back to this diagram again, in the capture direction, as I go this way, I have to be decreasing this ratio of these two speeds. I have to be increasing this ratio. But things we've been talking about alpha so far have always been decreasing alpha. So the answer, we think, is to have something that decreases g with time in the early solar system. So what could that be? Well, our best candidate is the Kuiper belt. If the Kuiper belt had more mass initially, which generally we think it does, then it affects Neptune more than anybody else, which is basically the frequency that we're looking for, the Neptune orbit precession. Here, for instance, is a diagram that Matt may recognize. This is from a Holman Wisdom model of the erosion of the Kuiper belt. Just can't see it very well. But as the Kuiper belt erodes, its contribution to the value of the new 1/8 frequency goes down, and we get adjustment in the correct direction. So this is our schematic of our concept. We're actually over here, and as the Kuiper belt dissipates, it gets captured into the, it starts with a small nuclei like Jupiter, gets captured, rolls up to 26.7 degrees. And the current value is simply what it winds up with when the Kuiper belt is essentially depleted. It's just a chance. It's nothing special about it, other than the fact that it's large compared to what we think it started with. And that's mostly having to do with the current masses and distances of the planets. However, this is not quite the whole picture because, here's a numerical experiment. In this case, we're not using a single term. We're using many hundreds of terms from a Bretignon theory of the secular variations, but sure enough, it selects out the new 1/8 perfectly. Here's an obliquity starting off very small. Here is the alpha over g. We're decreasing this by basically changing the Kuiper belt. We capture it in the resonance, and it rolls right up to basically, you know, its current value. But because we started off with very small obliquity, it's almost exactly in state two, as the theory would predict. But that's not what we actually see when we locate Saturn's pole. So here's the unit spin axis again. I removed all of the trajectory terms except for the separatrix. Here's a polar view of it. And if it started with zero obliquity and we ran it through the resonance in the capture direction, we'd expect the obliquity to be at state two, but it's not. It's basically, it has the same, roughly the same angle as state two, but it apparently is librating around state two. So that suggests, in fact, that prior to resonance passage in the capture direction, it did have an obliquity. And that obliquity is still larger than Jupiter's. So how do we get that obliquity? Well, this is the J2 issue that you were talking about. So there are more than one way to do this, and we don't know exactly which one is the most likely. But this one's my favorite, which is a double passage through this resonance, which can occur very naturally in the following way. During the Kelvin-Helmholtz contraction of Jupiter and Saturn, there are changes in the J2, and also the radius and so forth. And this changes the precession frequency, okay? But it decreases it. It decreases it. So this is passage in the non-capture direction. And we can ask, okay, if we're going to go through this very weak resonance, and we need a pre-capture obliquity large enough to account for our librations of somewhere between 5 and 10 degrees, we can ask, what is the time scale at which to go through this resonance to break the adiabatic invariant and get what we need? And we get a value of a few times 10 to the 7th years. Now, this is very much longer than the dissipation time scale for satellite disks. However, it is quite comparable to what we would expect the time scale for the contraction of Saturn during this period. So if this happens before the Kuiper belt is depleted, then we can execute a double passage through the resonance. The first one kicks the resonance. And here's another numerical experiment doing this. The first one, we start off with almost zero obliquity. We pass during the contraction phase through the resonance in the non-captured direction, we get a kick. Then the contraction slows down, gets slower than the Kuiper belt erosion, and the process turns around and starts back the other direction. We get capture. And this time we go ahead and raise it together with its libration up to its current value. And for instance, here is a polar view of the unit sphere compared to the position of Saturn. So for instance, in this diagram, you would start off with an obliquity almost zero, precessing in this direction. It, as you're starting approaching the resonance in the non-captured direction, you get a kick. Okay, then you're starting back the other direction again, and as a reversal, it goes up like this. It's captured, and then it starts librating like this. And of course, depending on what we pick to be these ratios, we can run one of these curves right through Saturn. Here's another example of slightly different rates. It's pretty robust. We can, you know, we can use a range of rates, and it just locks on every time and rolls up to where it is. Yeah.
I'm surprised you didn't reach for the stochastic migration to break the anti-impact.
Well, that's another possibility. I mean, you know, there's that. You can also produce this libration with an impact. It takes a lot less of an impact to produce this libration than to knock the obliquity completely over. So there, another way you can go through in the capture direction, but you can go through and break the adiabatic invariant slightly and pick up a libration too. So we can't uniquely claim that this is the way. But if this is correct, it does give us some interesting constraints on the contraction process too. Okay, so in summary, for Jupiter we find that in order to not get too large of an obliquity, we have to go through the new 1/6 very rapidly. So that tells us that the satellite disk is short-lived. For Saturn, we can excite this obliquity. In the case I've described here is a double passage through the resonance. We get a constraint on the moment of inertia for Saturn for it to be in the resonance right now, which is 0.225. You know, there are observations of the precession rate of Saturn, which are not good enough now to distinguish whether it's in the resonance or not. But there, you know, maybe it can be done in the future. So this would be an important test of this. Now, otherwise, but if it's not, that means it's just outside the separatrix, which is kind of uncomfortable, unless it was knocked out. You get, if the kick is due to the contraction, you can put constraints on that, and they're consistent with models. You need a certain amount of Kuiper belt mass to make sure that you spend some time on the correct side of the resonance so you can go through the resonance in the capture direction. And that's about a Neptune mass. It doesn't seem unreasonable. And it also implies that Saturn probably had a pretty small obliquity before all this happened, so that its formation is probably very similar to Jupiter's, a very small obliquity object. And then the last thing is sort of a funny aside, and that is we saw that Jupiter is actually very near the Uranus new 1/7. And if the spin axis precession rate of Jupiter increases, it actually is going to get captured. So at some time in the future, when the Galilean satellites move out a little bit further, Jupiter will begin to roll over just like Saturn is. Of course, that's very far in the future. That's it.
Jove's, if it turns over, you heard it here.
Yeah.
The last point was exactly what was bugging me all along during this time. What about, you know, you're looking at the spin orbit coming, but the satellites, what about the satellites' spin axis, and would they be affected by all of this?
No, because those processes are so fast. I mean, the satellites' spin axes themselves are going to be controlled
by the orbital. Yeah.
The orbits of the satellites?
The orbit of the satellites.
Oh, no, they're locked. They're locked firmly to the equator plane of the planet because their precession times, you know, even all the way out to Iapetus, it's only 3,000 years. So, yeah. And these are, you know, these things, these changes are occurring on 10 to the 7th years. So it's an adiabatic invariant. That was part of Peter Goldreich's thesis.
Okay.
Because, you know, just the precession of the planet itself
right.
is.
Right. Yes. Right.
Did Jupiter and Saturn mutate?
I don't think they've detected it. I mean, there is some because of the satellites, but it's extremely small. You know, when they do the measurements for the precession rate of Saturn, they use the ring plane crossing data. And there were two or three groups that did this, you know, and they were comparing it with this theoretical prediction of what the spin axis precession rate would be, and they were only getting 2/3 of the value. I said, well, why are we only getting 2/3 of the value for the precession rate? You know, that's a big error. That's for theory, you know. Well, it turns out it's because this is something Phil Nicholson figured out. There's a small free inclination of Titan, and the torques between the satellites and the planet themselves are so strong that if you just have a little bit of a free inclination, you actually cause a jitter in the precession rate of Saturn, and that jitter is on a 600 year time scale. So then they had to go get a satellite theory and sort of integrate this, take the current values and then integrate it and see what the time average over longer than this jitter, and that turns out to be right on the money. So the satellites are, you know, are locked very strongly to the equator plane by the mutual torques. The external torques are very weak compared to those. So there must be some mutation just from some jitter in Jupiter just from that. But, you know, we're talking very, very small. They're just trying to find out where the pole is in general, not these high frequency wiggles.
You have this 10-degree initial obliquity to Saturn because the contraction time scale is about 10 to 7 years. What would be the counterpart for Jupiter?
For what?
Just to give the initial.
You're talking about through which resonance? I mean, that was the question through the new 1.6. You have to go through that in 60,000 years, but we think you only access the new 1.6 by having a satellite disk, not an extended planet. To go through the new 1.7, which is the Uranus one. Contraction timescale would have to be somewhat faster in order to avoid. We figured about 10 to the 7th years would give us a 5 or 10 degree obliquity for Saturn. So it's not too different from that to give a 3 degree obliquity for Jupiter going through the new 1.7. So it's not too different. Well, that would be another way. That's another way of changing the new 1.8. It's more difficult because, in the case of the Kuiper, if you think of a Kuiper belt exterior to Neptune, then you don't have to worry about a lot about what the dynamics of that belt is, as long as it's further away. But if you immerse the object in the material, and you're migrating it by scattering material, like they think may have occurred in a somewhat earlier period of time, I don't know what those frequencies would be. I don't know what the new 1.8 would be at this point, or the new 1.7. We just haven't worked it yet. It's a more difficult problem. But that's another way it could be done. Those frequencies would probably be faster, so then you'd have to have the resonance passage a little bit earlier, so the planet would have to be a little bit larger, but we don't have numbers for it yet. This was the simplest problem we could work, and it seems to work fine, so.
If the objective is a soft planet, like for the Jupiter, is observed, and then the, what can you tell about the exosol planet formation history or other planet?
Well, one thing you might tell you that it could be in a resonance like this. You know, if it's a large planet, so we think it's a gas giant, then it's probably an evolutionary thing, not a formation. And so, you know, it may indicate that there's something, another planet in the system that's precessing the orbit plane in such a way as to have a resonance like this. Well, that's another thing we don't really know very well yet. We don't know what the damping time scale for. There must be some damping of these obliquities. The fact that Saturn is librating, damping would drive it to stay too. The fact that it's librating quite a bit suggests that damping time is long.
Can you put a constraint on?
You can't really, because, well, you can until we know what the moment of inertia is, because, you know, when we try to figure out what the libration amplitude is, you know, we're trying to put it inside a separatrix, right? I mean, we've got,
you switch on the light.
You know, here's a unit sphere and you're looking down on it, and so, okay, so here's the separatrix, and here's the pole, and so we're trying to decide, you know, and we know that it's out here somewhere, okay, but where the separatrix is, okay, depends on this alpha over g, and the biggest uncertainty in alpha is the moment of inertia of Saturn, which they can't really pinpoint better than 10% from theoretical models. And so you can move this, okay? And if I move it, then see if it's the way I've drawn it here, then there's an area, right, that this is in. But if I move it, okay, and it's closer to the edge, so then it may be quite a bit of different area. So I can't, without a better measurement of the moment of inertia, we can't get finer than that. So more data, more observations.
Very exciting.